From WBUR in Boston, I'm Karen Given, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Bill Littlefield is watching the World Cup in some exotic location this week, but he won't be watching the U.S. team, which was ousted from the tournament on Tuesday. Ahead on Only a Game, an assessment of the Americans' performance and a look ahead to 2018. Also, Penny Hardaway discusses his pro hoops career and the little version of himself, and Brandi Chastain campaigns against heading soccer balls. Also ahead, remembering Lou Gehrig's farewell speech on its 75th anniversary, and the WNBA embraces the LGBT community.
They didn't want to become viewed as a, quote, lesbian league. I look back 15 years ago, how far they've come, and it's just leaps and bounds.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield is at an undisclosed location writing out premature World Cup withdrawal syndrome. Unlike Bill's beloved Spain, the U.S. escaped group play and made it into the round of 16 at the 2014 World Cup. But does that accomplishment mean the national team was successful? And what does the U.S. program need to do over the next 4 years? Here with some answers is MLSsoccer.com editor-in-chief Greg Lallis. Greg, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
So what did the U.S. team accomplish in Brazil in terms of its competitiveness on the international stage?
It showed that it can continue to compete with the biggest teams in the world. You go up against the Portugals and the Germanys of the world, and you can hold your own. And in fact, you can actually beat some of them and escape the group of death.
In order to compete against that world-class talent, you need world-class players. So which players on the current U.S. roster fit into that category?
Tim Howard is a world-class goalkeeper, arguably one of the top three goalkeepers in the world right now. And the performance he put in against Belgium proved that. And I would say that a player like Matt Beisler plays for Sporting Kansas City. Other than sort of one little mistake against Belgium, I think he showed that he has the potential to be a world-class player.
Head coach Jurgen Klinsmann has been lauded by some for making the right substitutions at key moments, but he's been derided by others for not having a suitable backup for Jozy Altidore and maybe asking too much of midfielder Michael Bradley. How do you rate Klinsmann's performance?
I think that the criticism that he's come in for is all deserved. At the same time, considering the group that the U.S. was in, I don't think we could have asked for that much more from him. Yes, it would have been great if he'd had another target forward who could replace Jozy Altidore. It would have been nice if Michael Bradley could have played in his more preferred sort of withdrawn holding midfielder position. But it's not just about a collection of individuals. It's about, you know, that spirit and the cohesion and the understanding. And I think we all have to tip our hat to Klinsmann for getting that right.
Well, I think the fans at least are ready for this team to do more than just get out of the group stage. So what
Agreed.
Changes does the team need to make before 2018?
I think you're going to see Jurgen Klinsmann bringing in more young players. You know, we saw DeAndre Yedlin, this 20-year-old kid from Seattle, who came in as a sub early in that Belgium game and was arguably the best player on the field for the United States. If you can get a 20-year-old kid in now, you got 4 years to drill it into his head that he's just as good as that German player or that Portuguese player or that Belgian player. And I think in 2018, you're going to see a U.S. team that goes out there with that sort of mentality.
According to recent Nielsen ratings, more people viewed Tuesday's USA-Belgium match than the average number that tuned into the World Series and NBA Finals. Does this mean that the U.S. has finally caught on to soccer, or merely that we've finally caught on to the World Cup?
I would say that it is not that anybody has caught on to anything. It's that a lot of people have been exposed to the fan and the supporter culture that's out there. The energy, the buzz, the excitement that everybody felt during this tournament, that's taking place every single weekend at soccer stadiums across the United States and Canada already. It's not to the same scale, but look, they're getting 40,000 people to games in Seattle. In Kansas City, every game is sold out. There's a cultural moment taking place, and I think that this World Cup has just made some people kind of look and notice what was already right in front of them.
Greg Lawless is editor-in-chief of MLSsoccer.com, and he's a co-founder of the Kicking and Screening Soccer Film Festival, which is happening Sunday and Monday in Rio. Greg, thanks for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
During the group stage of the World Cup, there were more than 1,200 shots on goal. If you believe the internet, U.S. goalie Tim Howard saved all of them. But I digress. About 10% of those 1,200-plus shots went in. In contrast, since 1966, players have converted 81% of all World Cup penalty kicks. Kirk Goldsberry thinks that disparity merits a review. He examined the issue for Grantland in an article titled Crime and Punishment: Should the Penalty Kick Spot Be Moved Back? Kirk, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
To give our listeners a mental picture, describe the location of the penalty kick spot and how a penalty kick plays out on the field.
Well, the penalty kick spot is exactly 12 yards from the goal mouth, right in the center of the box. If you were going to try to line up the optimal shot to make a goal, it's pretty close to right where you would put it.
You write, in FIFA County, you go to the gallows for stealing a horse. You also go there for littering. Explain what you mean by that.
No matter what foul you commit in the box, no matter how egregious an act it is, the punishment is uniform in nature. In other words, if I trip somebody incidentally at the far corner of the box, or if I intentionally save a ball illegally with my hands as a non-goalie player, the penalty is the same.
In addition to the idea of simply moving the penalty kick back, you also float the concept of having two penalty kick spots. Describe how that might work.
In the case of the Netherlands-Mexico match from last weekend, where Arjen Robben was fouled, he wasn't shooting the ball, and no goal was imminent. Yet he went to a place to take that penalty kick where a goal was imminent. So having a second penalty spot, a second kick location, and a goal is less certain to occur would be more appropriate in cases like that. So a second spot may be 18 yards away.
We shared your article on our Facebook page earlier this week, and one listener sarcastically commented, yes, because less scoring is exactly what we need in soccer. How would you respond to that?
I appreciate that as an American. we've all had our times getting impatient with the scoring in soccer. However, the beautiful aspect of soccer is those free play goals. And I think we want to see those goals rightfully take their place in the hierarchy of soccer goals, as opposed to so many of these penalty kicks resulting in goals.
You've also written that it's time for the NBA to consider moving its three-point line. In the NFL, the extra point has come under fire for being too easy. Is there anything that's too hard and needs to move closer?
Oh, maybe in baseball, the fences. Maybe we could use some, maybe we could use some more home runs. But I have started to think a lot about the sort of arbitrary lines that demarc our playing surfaces in all these games. These things are hugely influential. And at least in American sports, you know, in baseball, we've raised and lowered the pitching mound in accordance with trying to keep a competitive balance between the pitcher and the hitter. This 12-yard line, for instance, has been there so long. The ball has changed. The players have changed. The game has changed. Maybe that dot on the field should change as well to try to keep that competitive balance intact.
Well, do you think FIFA will take your advice and at least review the penalty kick spot?
Oh, my Lord. No, I don't. I think if there's one organization that would look at an article like this and do the opposite, it's FIFA. To the NBA's credit, they have and continue to look at their playing surface and those lines as a work in progress. Whereas I think the mentality in soccer is to look at this as almost a perfected system.
Kirk Goldsberry is a professor and a staff writer for Grantland. You can link to his article, Crime and Punishment: Should the Penalty Kick Spot Be Moved Back, at our website, onlyagame.org. Thanks, Kirk.
Thanks for having me.
The Tour de France is underway, having set off from British soil for only the second time in its 111-year history. Each year, this race takes a different path through Western Europe, and this year the route commemorates the 1914 Tour and the cycling champions who died during World War I. Suze Clementson recounted that history for The Guardian this week. Suze, I'd like you to start by describing the stages of this race that might be the most historically significant.
Stage 5 starts in the shadow of the Menin Gate, the huge memorial at Ypres to the missing soldiers of the British and Commonwealth forces. There are 54,500 names of soldiers whose bodies were simply never found. And in fact, every evening they have a ceremony in which the lone bugler plays the last post. So that will be an extremely moving stage.
Philippe Thys, who won the 1914 race, would return to win again, but many of his competitors died during the war, including 1909 champion François Fabert. Tell me about him.
He was a Luxembourgeois. He also hated the heat on one particularly hot stage during the 1909 tour. He stopped at a cafe and said that he was going no further. But he was persuaded to continue to race. And in fact, he won six stages in total.
And is he the one who didn't end the race on his bike?
He dropped his chain about 3 kilometres from the finish line and he simply picked his bike up and ran. And the crowd went mad. But that was the stuff that those early riders were made of. These are men who would have to get up sometimes at sort of 4 o'clock in the morning in order to ride 400 kilometres during the day. And of course, even in those early days, they were going over mountain passes, most of which would have been not much more than goat tracks.
France lost nearly 1.4 million young men in combat during World War I. Belgium lost just over 58,000. Beyond being an extraordinary and very sad statistic, these numbers also had a huge impact on the tour when it returned after the war. How so?
France lost an entire nation of champions. I mean, if you look at the young riders who had participated in the tour, who were killed in World War I, for some of them, the 1914 Tour de France was their first and only experience of that race. Whereas the Belgians, it seems awful to say that any kind of loss of life in war is getting off lightly. But yes, there was relatively little loss of life. So the Belgians had begun to dominate the race and continued to do so after World War I.
The 2014 Tour de France will clearly be meaningful for the communities it passes through, but will defending champion Chris Froome, perennial favorite Alberto Contador, and the rest of the peloton have time to pay attention to history?
On stage six, which goes from Arras to Reims, which follows the Chemin des Dames, which saw major combat in 1917, the French have planted cornflowers in remembrance. And during the podium presentation, the best young rider's jersey, which I think is particularly poignant, will bear a blue cornflower. And of course, the act of remembrance for World War I won't stop in this race in 2014. It will go on until 2018.
Freelance cycling writer Suze Clementson wrote about the 1914 tour for The Guardian. More on the subject can be found in her book, 100 Tours, 100 Tales. Suze, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
I'm Karen Given. Coming up on Only a Game, I find out why the CrossFit exercise bearing my name is so difficult to complete. But first...
Now, pin it. I want to say hello to my man Kevin Garnett.
Kevin Garnett?
Yeah, Garnett. We went to high school together. Tell him Little Penny from the Science Club says hello. Can you do that for a brother?
That's former NBA star Penny Hardaway and his alter ego, Lil Penny, voiced by comedian Chris Rock. If you turned on a television set between 1994 and 1998, you're probably familiar with those commercials. Lil Penny is not the reason why Penny Hardaway was inducted into the National High School Hall of Fame this week. His 15 seasons in the NBA, 4 All-Star Game appearances, and Olympic gold medal helped. But it was his work after retirement, coaching kids in his old neighborhood in Memphis, Tennessee, that inspired the selection committee to choose him. Hardaway's fellow inductees included Chisholm, Minnesota high school basketball coach Bob McDonald, who retired after 59 seasons without a single technical foul. When Hardaway heard that stat, he immediately stood up and applauded. I got the chance to sit down with Hardaway for a few minutes, and I started by asking him if he ever thought he'd be inducted into a Hall of Fame.
Absolutely not. I mean, I played the game of basketball just for the love of the game. It was definitely an outlet for me. It was my neighborhood's number one sport. We played all day and all night. And never in a million years would I have ever thought that I would have been in a National High School Hall of Fame. I mean, I know I had a great career, but never once did I ever think, oh, man, these numbers are going to get me into the Hall of Fame. I never thought that at all.
So you told this group that your high school teammates were like your family. How was that?
Well, you know, I was an only child, and my mother wanted to pursue a singing career, so she left and pursued a singing career and left me with my grandmother. And I was an only child. My dad, I hadn't met him. He left before I was born. So when I went to school, the guys that I played ball with, we bonded. You know, they were like my brothers. So, you know, the coach was like my father, and my teammates were like my brothers, and that was just a real true family, and that's how we reacted around each other every day.
So I would assume that has something to do with the fact that after you made a reported $120 million in the NBA, you decided to go back to your neighborhood, to your junior high school, and coach. What was that decision? Why did you decide to do that?
You know, it was weird how that happened, but a good childhood friend of mine was diagnosed with colon cancer, and he was the head coach of Lester Middle School at the time, and he asked me to come in and help as he was going through chemotherapy, and he was so weak that he couldn't sit on the benches. Of course, you know, going through chemo, there's only so much you can do, and you don't have the energy to go on a daily basis. So I took over the team, and I was only supposed to take over for 1 year, and it ended up being 3 years, and it's been a great time. He's still, you know, having his battles with cancer, but he's feeling much better, and I'm still at the school.
3 years, three city championships, three state championships. Obviously, you have a lot of talent on the court, but what's your biggest challenge off the court?
I think the biggest challenge off the court is none of these kids have their fathers in their lives, and their mothers are working multiple jobs, so they have a lot of idle time, and they become the babysitters of their other siblings. A kid isn't supposed to be babysitting his brothers and sisters his whole childhood. He's supposed to be a kid. I think the disadvantages of that is that you just never get out, never have any fun, never get the chance to dream. You're always stuck at home. And, you know, the challenge is really to just continue to just push these kids in a positive direction and not think about the negative.
Because there is a lot of negative in the community you grew up in, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pride in our neighborhood, but there still is a lot of gang affiliation. There's a lot of fighting. There's a lot of more negative things to see in that neighborhood than positive. But, you know, it's what you make it. You know, it's what you see yourself as. It's what you see yourself making it out. And I always challenge these kids to dream. Dream big. Dream what you want and then go get it.
Well, so what is your goal for these kids? Do you want them all to become NBA players?
I want them all to go to college. I think that will be my greatest, well, my, the job that I want to do, my greatest effort towards what I've done for these kids is just to get them all to go to college, whether it be on an athletic scholarship or academic scholarship. The NBA, I don't really worry about that.
You stood for the coach up here who coached for all those years and never had a technical foul. I assume that's not easy for you.
No, you know, I'm such a competitor. Not saying that coach wasn't, but there's times during the game where you lose it, or maybe one game out of a year, and you might say something that you shouldn't say, and you get a technical. But I do applaud him. I thought that was amazing.
I also want to talk to you about you made it to the NBA Finals in 2005 with Orlando, but you were swept. Do you ever look back and say, oh, what if?
There isn't a day that goes by that I don't think about that Finals with the Houston Rockets, because I just felt like we were a play away. They were a veteran team, and we were a young team, and maybe that's what took them over the hump. But I just felt like we had the better team, and it didn't happen that way. I mean, they swept us. But, you know, I do think about that every day.
So I have just one more question, and it's because my editor told me today that he's completely freaked out by Lil Penny. So I want to know where Lil Penny ranks in the list of your career accomplishments.
You know, Lil Penny might be first, maybe a close second to being drafted into the NBA. But, you know, Little Penny thrusted me to another level because everybody loved that ad with Nike. And Nike did an unbelievable job, and it's still going to this day. I've been retired now for 5-6 years, and Little Penny is stronger than ever, like it was 1996. So Little Penny has done a lot for my career.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That's Penny Hardaway, 15-year veteran of the NBA, junior high basketball coach, and 2014 inductee into the National High School Hall of Fame. Beginning the last week in May and continuing for more than a month, the best-selling item across all NBA platforms was a simple white T-shirt decorated with a rainbow-colored basketball. The top right corner of the shirt displayed the WNBA logo.
I'm a fan of the WNBA, but even I'm surprised when it is able to surpass the NBA. You know, we live in a culture where the men are supposed to be king and they're supposed to always be king.
Sid Ziegler is co-founder of Outsports.com. He says in the early years of the WNBA, executives held backroom conversations about how to avoid becoming known as a, quote, lesbian league. But teams needed to sell tickets, and they weren't picky about who they sold them to. Back in May of 2001, the Los Angeles Times reported on a first-of-its-kind partnership between the LA Sparks and a lesbian social club. The newspaper asked, was this a bad move for the Sparks? Would this send a signal to mothers to discourage their daughters from attending Sparks games? Or was this courageous and innovative, pinpointing a group with disposable income and an interest in sports? Sid Ziegler attended the next Sparks game to see for himself.
And I looked at the fans, and it was a lot of families. And I talked to various fans who said in 2001, I guess it was, that they didn't care. The vast majority of fans don't care that they're sitting next to a lesbian couple. They just want to go to a game.
Partnerships between teams and LGBT organizations are now common. And this May, the WNBA announced that it would become the first sports league to celebrate LGBT pride during a nationally televised game.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's WNBA Pride Day.
At that game 2 weeks ago between the Chicago Sky and the Tulsa Shock, the Sky Guy, Chicago's aviation-themed mascot, wore a rainbow boa. A couple of players wore rainbow-colored shoes. Sky fan Chris Woodard admitted that rainbows aren't exactly a new sight around the league.
I have a Mystics t-shirt that's a rainbow, and that must be 10 years old. Of course, sometimes a rainbow is just a rainbow. But it's very impressive that they took that step, I think. Very impressive.
That anything at all was different on that Sunday afternoon was lost on some fans. Bryce Jones-Leonard, a veteran of at least 10 Sky home games, didn't even seem to know what it meant when he was told that he was attending the WNBA Pride game.
Oh, yeah, my spirit is up for that. You know, I'm ready to see that win.
Pat Griffin, professor emerita at the University of Massachusetts, says many of the WNBA's Pride events haven't been as visible as they could have been.
When you think about how public and how visible campaigns have been for breast cancer, for example, in women's sports, I mean, everything is pink.
Griffin says the WNBA's campaign is a good start, but it should have come a lot sooner.
You have to look at the WNBA in the context of sexism in sport as well as homophobia in sport. Because the women's, all women's professional leagues really have to struggle for their share of the media attention, it's been very challenging for them to take on anything that they perceive as potentially controversial that might affect the bottom line.
Griffin says the league is finally feeling comfortable enough to cash in on larger changes in society regarding marriage equality and civil rights. And cashing in is exactly what the league is doing.
You know, Nike came out with these Pride shoes. They're the Hyper Revs, and I love it. I love it.
After the game, Tulsa Shock power forward Glory Johnson showed reporters her rainbow-colored shoes. In today's WNBA, it's sometimes hard to draw the line between marketing ploy and social justice movement. But for Sid Ziegler, drawing a line misses the point.
I just don't care if Barack Obama is pandering to the LGBT community and ends up supporting equality for it, or the WNBA wants us to buy tickets and jerseys, and so they're doing the same. I don't care. As long as kids today and tomorrow grow up in a world where they realize they can be the president of the United States or a professional athlete, I really don't care what their motives are. They're doing the right thing.
In 2005, there were just 13 bare-bones CrossFit gyms called boxes across the country. By early 2012, there were 3,400 around the world, and according to the math I did this morning, that number has now risen to right around 9,500. J.C. Hertz wrote about the phenomenon in her new book, Learning to Breathe Fire, The Rise of CrossFit and the Primal Future of Fitness. The author joins me from NPR in D.C. J.C. Hertz, welcome to Only a Game.
Great to be here.
Let's start with what might be the easiest and the most complicated question. What is CrossFit and how is it different from the exercise I see and do at my local gym?
So if you ask a CrossFit coach, there's this kind of catechism, constantly varied functional movement executed at high intensity across broad time and modal domains. And what that really means is it's never the same thing twice. And it's going to be a combination of lifting heavy things, running fast, and getting your body through space that are mixed up in 100 different combinations. And there are these different attributes of fitness, from agility to power to speed, endurance, stamina. And then there's this mythos of, when the zombie apocalypse comes, will you be ready? And there's a line in Learning to Breathe Fire that every CrossFitter secretly believes that the people in his box will be the ones to survive the zombie apocalypse.
CrossFit is known for the workout of the day, or WOD. Many are named after women, and Karen sounds really simple. It's just one exercise, the wall ball. But you describe Karen as a WOD that tests an athlete's ability to endure discomfort. And as a woman named Karen, I have to ask, what makes me so uncomfortable?
So there's this exercise in CrossFit called the wall ball, where you take a medicine ball, which is 20 pounds for men and 14 pounds for women, and you go down into a deep squat, and then you launch yourself up and you throw the ball up against a target, which is 9 feet in the air if you're a woman, or 10 feet in the air if you're a man. And then you catch it and go back into a deep squat, and you do that 150 times in the workout called Karen. And one of my purposes in this book is to convey the internal psychic experience of CrossFit. Because you look through the window and you see people, oh, they're tossing balls up against the wall. That kind of looks goofy. But they don't grasp the level of misery of actually doing this and how deep you have to dig spiritually to actually get this thing done. CrossFit is the only modern thing that lets Joanne from Human Resources feel like a Marine 4 times a week.
Christmas Abbott was working for a military contractor in Iraq when she was shown an online video of three women performing the WOD called Nasty Girls. One of the women, Nicole Carroll, struggles. She fails over and over again, and she finally finishes in tears. What was it about that video that made Christmas want to find a workout that would make her cry?
This woman, Nicole Carroll, who finished last in this video against these other two amazing female athletes. They were like the Charlie's Angels of fitness at that time. One of them had been an Olympian. She was humiliated because she'd finished so far behind. And so this video was going up on the internet. So she viewed, oh, well, I've been humiliated and it's going to be in public in front of all my peers. Lovely. And what happened was that all these male athletes came out of the blue to say, you know, way to gut it out, Nicole. If I had half your heart, I'd be twice the athlete that I am today. And these were special operators. And so there's this thing about the CrossFit tribe responding not to your athletic performance so much as to your courage.
CrossFit's unofficial mascots are Pukey the Clown and Uncle Rabdo. We've already talked a bit about the puking, but Uncle Rabdo refers to rhabdomyolysis, which is a serious and potentially life-threatening condition. It can cause permanent kidney damage, and it's caused by overworking muscles. So why hasn't CrossFit dialed back the intensity after numbers of athletes were struck with Uncle Rabdo?
So first of all, rhabdo is very, very rare. The general prevalence of rhabdo is not the everyday Jane or Joe who walks in off the street. It's the person who used to be a little bit of a bad boy or bad girl, used to be a triathlete. Those are the people who, in my opinion and in the evidence that I've seen, are at the highest risk for injury.
But just like I would say to a football coach who had a bunch of players come in the summer and had this happen to them, don't CrossFit gyms say, huh, maybe we should watch out for this a little more?
Oh, yeah. Most CrossFit gyms, they don't even let people who haven't done CrossFit into the CrossFit classes until they've done a course called either Foundations or Elements. So there's a lot of observation that goes on in CrossFit, and this stuff is vanishingly rare. It's present, but there's an interesting discussion in the book that has to do with risk. Right? Because there's risk here, there's risk in, you know, if you want to run a marathon, there's risk in most sports.
You refer to the cruelty of the CrossFit gods. You run through the typical born-again CrossFit story, and you even explain that some of these athletes feel alienated from their old friends after finding CrossFit. So what makes you describe this as, quote, a good cult?
It's not one of these exploitive cult of personality type of cults. It has a lot of social cohesion. It has a lot of ritual associated with it. Someone said that CrossFit's a cult kind of like parenthood. It's a cult. You know, people have a baby and then they become obsessed with it and they can't talk about anything else. And the reason for that is that it transforms them. It gives them a different perspective on life. I was never on teams. I'm an excellent example of what you can do with zero genetic potential for sports. And I felt like when I got into CrossFit, wow, I finally made the team. I'm 38 years old and, you know, I'm on the team. I got chosen for the team. And these people, these super athletes were cheering for me when I was, you know, struggling for a strict press. And that is a pretty delightful experience.
J.C. Hertz is the author of Learning to Breathe Fire, The Rise of CrossFit and the Primal Future of Fitness. J.C. Hertz, thanks for joining me.
Great to be here.
To read an excerpt from Learning to Breathe Fire, please visit onlyagame.org and tell them Karen sent you.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Eton, offering the American Red Cross radio line, a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel, now at Radio Shack. And the Music Emporium, for 45 years, offering collectible boutique and vintage acoustic guitars, themusicemporium.com. This is NPR.
I'm Karen Given, filling in for Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, 75 years after Lou Gehrig's famous farewell speech, we talk about what made that moment endure. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
The New York Knicks and the Los Angeles Lakers have presented their best offers to free agent Carmelo Anthony. Anthony has also met with the Chicago Bulls and the Dallas Mavericks. Where does Melo go?
I don't know, but the Knicks are offering him $129 million, and given the inconvenience of moving, I'd stay right where I was. This is a lot of rock to be breaking over a guy who's going to really make you feel miserable about halfway through next season.
The Houston Rockets posted a picture of Anthony in a number 7 jersey. Wait, don't they already have someone at number 7?
Yes, that's Jeremy Lin, a very charismatic and well-thought-of basketball player. Everybody seems to be taking it in good spirits, though, although Lin apparently may wind up with the 76ers.
Free agent LeBron James is on vacation with his family this week and letting his agent handle face-to-face meetings with the teams courting his talents. Is this good news for those who hope LeBron isn't serious about leaving South Beach?
I don't know. I think my feeling is that at least he and Dwayne Wade will be where they are next year. There'll be some rejiggering of contracts. Chris Bosh may well wind up somewhere else, perhaps even Houston. But I think Wade and James will be back in Miami.
With exactly 1 year of coaching experience, Jason Kidd, formerly of the Brooklyn Nets, apparently wanted a better deal, and the Milwaukee Bucks were willing to give it to him. Isn't it a little early in his coaching career for Kidd to be making these sorts of moves?
Well, no, not really, if he can actually do it. I mean, it was a fine business move, and I spent 5 years in Milwaukee, and I can't understand why anybody would want to live anywhere else.
The U.S. was knocked out of the World Cup on Tuesday, Charlie, and now we have dueling
theories.
Is that
why Bill isn't here?
He's broken up. We now have dueling theories about the future of the team. Coach Jurgen Klinsmann says the team is now ready to win it all. And former team member Landon Donovan says the U.S. is, quote, not set up to succeed. Who's right?
I think Klinsmann is right. I think every move he made looked like it worked out pretty well. And I think Landon Donovan should come to grips with the fact that he is no longer the future of American soccer and stop whining about stuff.
I've got a tip for you, Charlie. If you're an NFL player trying to convince your team and an arbitrator that you're a wide receiver, it's best not to call yourself a tight end on your Twitter bio.
Yeah, that's true. Jimmy Graham down in New Orleans had a lot of money depending on him being classified as a wide receiver and not a tight end. And given the fact that the NFL is now full of these hybrid positions and everybody playing everything else, Bill Belichick being the master of the form, once playing Richard Seymour, a defensive lineman at running back, Graham apparently thought he had a case, but no, because he's self-identifying out there in cyberspace as a tight end, he's going to be a tight end for the purposes of being paid.
Well, I mean, he lost $5 million on this deal. Shouldn't the guy who led the league in touchdowns last season have a little bit more bargaining
power?
Well,
see, that's the thing. I think the International Brotherhood of Tight Ends should get together and go on strike. They're obviously being undervalued at that position.
Seven former NFL players have filed an official objection to the proposed NFL concussion settlement. They're asking the judge to throw out the deal that they say is only good for the league and the lawyers. Do they have a shot?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't looked at the grounds for the lawsuit against the settling parties. One of the objections is that the players who suffered these injuries in what used to be NFL Europe wouldn't be covered. They're also objecting to the fact that the plaintiffs in this case, the lawyers involved, didn't conduct any discovery. So there's no way to really know if the deal was fair or not. I don't know about the NFL Europe thing, but that particular element would seem to be very compelling and worth going on with.
Charlie, once again, Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig has threatened to allow a team to move if a local government didn't give that team a better stadium deal. And again, the local government seems to have obliged. Who's the lucky city this time around?
That would be Oakland, where I was spending a couple of days only a couple of weeks ago with the Oakland A's in town against our own Boston Red Sox. Plenty of good seats were still available for the set. Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, this will be the last legacy of Bud Selig, who's a company man from start to finish.
I don't pretend to be interested in how the Toronto Blue Jays scored a run on Thursday by using a replay challenge to have their own runner called out. But I will suggest that maybe these replays are slowing down an already very slow game.
Now, in addition, if you're in the National League, to the great spectacle of watching managers try to think, you can have umpires sitting there chatting with each other while you sit there and drink your $8 beer. Yeah, the delay was 4 minutes and 27 seconds, or roughly the same time it takes Clay Buchholz to throw one pitch.
And finally, Charlie, you endured days of testimony.
I did.
In
this
the Ed O'Bannon
trial.
So I think you would appreciate Mark Emmert Appreciation Night, hosted by the Lake County Captains of East Link, Ohio. How exactly does a minor league baseball team appreciate the president of the NCAA?
Well, under cross-examination, Emmert said that we have to keep unpaid labor in college sports because, and I will quote him directly, to convert college sports into professional sports would be tantamount to converting into minor league sports. And we know that in the United States, minor league sports aren't very successful either for fan support or the fan experience. Bosh, say the Lake County Captains, who had Mark Emmert Appreciation Night, where they had not only the distribution of the very same NCAA video games that may well get the NCAA whacked over the head by a 2x4, they also had occasional $100 handshakes distributed to fans who wore generic college jerseys that may or may not correspond to a famous athlete who had attended that college. And they also crowned their own BCS champion, and the prize was an autographed basketball from Ed O'Bannon. I think I may become a Lake County Captains fan for life.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce on Grantland, among other places. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Flying saves and sliding tackles are the stuff of office chatter during this year's World Cup. They're also probably inspiring a few reenactments on this country's playgrounds. But there's one soccer move one World Cup star says kids shouldn't try at home. Brandi Chastain won two Women's World Cups with the U.S. team. And Brandi, what's the move you'd rather children under 14 not try?
Well, having grown up in soccer and having done a lot of heading in my career, I'm now working with the Institute of Sports Law and Ethics at Santa Clara University and the Sports Legacy Institute in Boston. And I've come to realize that heading the ball as a youngster is not really something that we should encourage. The repetitiveness of heading can potentially cause some injury. Heading is something that an older, more mature player can physically handle and doesn't need to be taught when our kids are under 14.
For parents whose kids play recreationally, this will probably be an easy sell. But what about parents of very talented soccer players? Would those athletes be put at a disadvantage by not learning how to head the ball at the same time as their peers?
I think the question is really valid, and I think there will be some parents out there that say, oh, my kid will get behind. But what I'm saying is we take out heading and we teach more skills with our feet. You know, the problem is, in working with Dr. Bob Cantu at SLI, the ratio of the velocity of the ball to the strength in young people's necks, it's hard for them to protect themselves. And if we take that variable out and we give it to them when they're ready to be more dynamic and more aggressive, the better for everybody.
Years ago, I interviewed your former national team teammate, Cindy Parlow-Cohn, about her decision to retire after suffering post-concussion syndrome. Is Cindy's story a common one in your sport?
I'm not so sure how you would define common, but unfortunately, I've heard more and more stories like Cindy's, and Dr. Bob Cantu has said himself he would rather not have to retire another young athlete from any sport due to concussion. So our jobs are to see what's coming and help our kids to navigate their lives in a safe and healthy way. The reason why I got involved, I have a young son who's 8 years old. He's starting to play soccer. I coach his team. And for me, as a soccer lover and soccer fan, I also would love to be able to impact the game in a positive way and leave it better for my kids, leave it better for future generations going forward.
I can't have you on the phone and not ask one more question. The World Cup is getting a lot of attention in the U.S. this time around. Do you expect that momentum to carry us into the Women's World Cup next summer?
Oh, I'm knocking on wood, crossing my fingers and my toes and my eyes that yes, that it will. I think soccer in this country has developed so much since 1999, which is not that long ago when we last won the World Cup. And I just feel that these are generations now that since 99 that are growing up knowing that soccer is an American sport. It's not taking the place of any other sport. It's just being added to our sports landscape. Obviously, with the tens of thousands of people who went to local stadiums, community plazas that were cheering while watching on the big screen together with their faces painted. I mean, they were thousands of miles away from Brazil, and yet they were loving it. And I really think that it will carry over next year. And we've got a great team that's going to be taking us to the Women's World Cup. So it's very exciting.
In conjunction with the Sports Legacy Institute and Santa Clara University, Brandi Chastain, along with former teammates Cindy Parlow-Cohn and Joy Fawcett, is campaigning against headers for soccer players under the age of 14. Brandi Chastain, thanks for joining me.
It's my pleasure. And if anybody would like more information, they can go to safersoccer.org and check it out. And hopefully leagues, coaches, and administrators will sign on and be a part of this great movement.
Are you a current or ex-soccer player who has headed the ball one too many times? Or are you a parent with concerns about what happens when ball meets forehead? Tell us how you feel about Brandi Chastain's campaign by going to facebook.com/onlyagamenpr. Only a Game NPR is also our Twitter handle.
I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. That I might have been given a bad break, but I've got an awful lot to live for. Thank you.
On July 4th, 1939, one of baseball's greatest players stepped up to a microphone at Yankee Stadium and delivered what would become one of the most famous speeches in sports history. Just 2 years later, Lou Gehrig died after suffering from ALS, a disease that would take on his name. The speech lives on in part because of its simple, striking language, but also because of Gary Cooper's famous turn as Gehrig in the film Pride of the Yankees. To mark the 75th anniversary of the moment, Richard Sandomir examined the speech's history for Sports on Earth. Richard, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be here again.
Lou Gehrig lived in the public eye, but he did not love the spotlight in the way his Yankees teammate Babe Ruth did. Do you think Gehrig was reluctant to deliver the speech that day?
Well, I think he knew he had to say something because he and his wife worked on the speech the night before. You get a sense, though, that he didn't bring a copy of it with him. He spoke extemporaneously. He seemed a little reluctant, perhaps because he was overwhelmed with emotion. Contemplative, he seemed emotional, and his voice cracked, and he did have tears while making the speech. So his personality wasn't suited to be deep in the spotlight the way Babe Ruth was. He was a mama's boy. He was a quiet guy who lived in Babe Ruth's spotlight, as almost everybody else did. So I think he understood he had to say something, and he said as much as he needed to say, and he said it very, very well.
The iconic line from the speech is, "Yet today I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth." But the whole text is fewer than 300 words, and there are other really touching moments. What other lines stand out to you?
Well, it's how many people he thanked and the language that he used. When the New York Giants, a team you would give your right arm to beat and vice versa, sends you a gift, that's something. When everybody down to the groundskeepers and those boys in white coats remember you with trophies, that's something. I mean, he remembered his mother-in-law and the groundskeepers in the speech. You know, it was important for him to mention the big people, teammates, his managers, the owner, the president, Ed Barrow. He remembered everybody, and he grew up with immigrant roots. It was probably his impulse to thank the so-called little people whose names you never hear.
Right. Well, he also, as you mentioned, thanked his teammates, and we have a little clip of that here.
Wouldn't you consider it privilege to associate yourself with such a fine-looking man as is standing in uniform in this ballpark today?
You make the point that it almost sounds like Gehrig had a ghostwriter. How so?
Well, he wasn't known for making speeches. He was a Columbia graduate, so we can't dismiss his intelligence. But a speech that good that doesn't seem hackneyed now, 75 years later, to me suggests that he may have had somebody read over it or help him write it. I'm just saying, when you look at goodbye speeches for athletes of all sorts in the last 75 years, you haven't found one that is as structured as well and written as well. So it suggests to me that at least he had a little help.
Well, it is clear that it is so very well written, but we also don't have a great record of exactly what he said. I mean, in the age of DVRs and social media, how is it that this speech wasn't immediately transcribed somewhere?
Well, I don't think anybody expected something like this. It wasn't like this was a presidential inaugural or something where you'd expect there to be a transcript. What's interesting to me also is that when you played that clip of him thanking his teammates, that's different than the official version. He deviated from the text several times. And to me, it's interesting that he said the luckiest man line early in the speech, and in the movie, it was moved to the last line of the speech for more cinematic impact.
Well, I was going to say the film Pride of the Yankees, starring Gary Cooper, gives us yet a third version. What are the key differences other than that one change?
Well, it's shorter. It thanks fewer people. It's still nicely written. The speech in the movie is barely 200 words, and the one in real life is about 270. So they left out a lot, but it's still kind of an amazing speech and still provokes a lot of emotion. And if you listen to the little clip that you had of Gehrig, he had a very, very thick Manhattan accent. Cooper was from Montana, and he had this lovely baritone. And you just wonder, do people remember the speech because they heard Cooper or because they've heard the few clips left of Gehrig from the newsreels? It's an interesting exercise in memory.
Well, it sure is. And it sounds like a lot of people heard the speech from Cooper himself.
That's what it seems to me, because the movie came out in 42, and it probably got its second life in TV reruns, and then VCR, and then DVDs. So I'm almost certain that more people have heard the whole speech through Cooper's version than anything they've heard from Gehrig. We think we know the official version, but what we've heard may not be a perfect rendition of what he said. So, yeah, I think Cooper is the reason that the speech has lasted and endured as well. We never heard Lincoln deliver his Gettysburg Address, but we kind of know some of the key lines. Imagine if there were a great version done by an actor that has not endured, whether Raymond Massey or Daniel Day-Lewis or whoever's played Lincoln. Have any of them delivered a speech as memorably as Gary Cooper did of Gehrig's speech?
Do you think there will ever be another speech in sports that is as remembered as this one?
I don't think so, because I think when athletes retire, it's often at a press conference where they may have prepared remarks, but they don't have the resonance. They're not dying. They may be dying their athletic death, but they're not dying. So this is more than just a retirement speech. This is a farewell speech.
Richard Sandomir, thanks for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
You can link to Richard Sandomir's article for Sports on Earth titled Words to Remember and watch a new video from Major League Baseball with current big league first baseman reading the lines from Gehrig's speech at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Doug Tribou. Our technical director is James Trout. We had help this week from Martin Kessler and Bill Healy. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word is from Brandi Chastain, who expresses her affinity for a nice mugful of hot water.
I'm hydrated. I hear it's good for digestion. I'm living the dream. Later on, hopefully, and when I'm in my hundreds, they're going to say, what really was the key? And I'm going to say hot water.
There you have it. Brandi's prescription for good health. Lots of hot water and no soccer balls hitting the head. I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield returns next week. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. The Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org. And the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.